Hi, I'm Yun Lee.
And I'm James Parnell.
And we are the hosts of Bar Talk.
Bar Talk is a lecture, performance, and storytelling series that usually takes place in different bars in The Hague. Each event has its own theme where we feature four guests with different perspectives.
In this season finale of our mini-series on apologies and atonement, we're excited to have Sofia Hernandez-Chongkui, director of the Art Institute, MELI. Sofia is an art curator, an occasional writer, and a constant traveler. Since 2018, she's been the director of MELI, the institution formerly known as Wit de Wit Center for Contemporary Art in Rotterdam.
We'll be talking to Sofia about the institutional transformation that comes with the name change, how she and her team navigated the politics both inside and out of the institution, and the role that humor should have in the art sector. Let's welcome Sofia.
Welcome, Sofia. Thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat with us.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
All right. So, Sofia, you were working in Caracas in Venezuela and New York before you started your position in MELI 2018. So our first question is pretty basic. Why did you take the position at MELI?
I took it for a very clear reason. I have known about the institution since I was a student in the 1990s. I studied art history, arts administration, and that was a new program in Mexico that had initiated in the north of Mexico where new museums were being built in Monterrey. And in the 1990s, immediately after my studies, I went to do graduate work in New York. And among the institutional references that we studied because of their strong exhibition history, it was Wit de Wit Center for Contemporary Art. In the 1990s, there was a lot of focus in art history and art making that focused on site specificity, meaning the way in which artists investigated the history of a place and created artwork, most of the time ephemeral, most of the time also in engagement with communities locally. And yeah, our institution, now called Kunstinstitut MELI, was founded actually in 1990, and during that decade, it really set the tone in terms of what site specificity looked like, what public art commissions and community engagement looked like, and it was also one institution that we studied not only for those reasons, but for reasons of the way in which they were presenting artists that were outside of the mainstream. And the mainstream has been called the art market. The mainstream has also been called the Western canon. And so, it was an opportunity for me to come here and work at an institution that had been a part of my artistic formation in terms of sensibility and in terms of, institutional histories and exhibition formats that had been inspiring since I was much younger. So I decided to apply and to eventually accept the position of director, knowing that it was a challenge to contribute to a history of programming that had been formative not only to me, but to many arts professionals and to artists. And I wanted to be challenged by this history and be able to contribute to the way in which an institution such as this has catalyzed so many discussions and has also generated a lot of different debates about what art is and what art can do in community and at its encounter.
I mean, to me, it sounds like you know like this enormous amount of the history of Kunsthal MELI. And so we're also really curious in thinking about like the name change. I know that you know a lot about the history of the institution, but we're curious for you, what was it like to be put in a completely new cultural and historical context and be kind of at the forefront of being in the process of the name change and helping Kunsthal MELI make that name change?
Well, first of all, at my arrival and even during my application process and interviews, I really didn't know that I would have to face this challenge that the institution had been undergoing, during 2017. So at my arrival, history is something that gets suspended because the important thing is to address the sheer reality of the present, and particularly when there is so much urgency in the debates that are being, you know, steering the decisions of an institution. So the first thing that I have to say is that it was very scary. I was overwhelmed at my arrival here and what it felt to arrive at a context, which is very much at the gist of your question, is it felt scary, and it felt that I had a historical interest in the institution, but what I had to really focus on was understanding the kind of historical present of the location and the community which the institution had been surrounded by and had been at times engaged with and at times disconnected to. Mm-hmm. So it felt like a lot of work had to be done that was not exactly a desk work, clerical work, research-based work, but that it was work that involved, yeah, public engagement and what we would call art historically field work. And by that I mean literally just going out and listening, going out and understanding, going out and looking and seeing and feeling what were the tensions and what were the realities and the background of those realities that had shaped the public debates and that had triggered the open letter that the institution responded to at the end of 2017, as you've said, and that made them decide that it was a moment to acknowledge, and an action to be taken was to change the name of the institution that referred to a colonial history that it for sure didn't want to be associated with. So that's what it meant. It meant that a lot of understanding of the present and of the debates that were being stirred, not only at our institution, but in the Netherlands as a whole, I had to learn about that in fast forward. So learning can happen so quickly, and learning about how the institution, was run throughout these years, how the institution could change structurally and philosophically. All these were things that had to happen at my arrival, and that would have had to happen at the arrival, I would say, of any other director that would have taken the position at that time.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, this sounds like such a huge thing to try to navigate through. And we're also sure that there were politics that you were having to maybe swim through, both within the institution and outside of the institution. So where did you start, and who were you talking to in this process?
Yeah, I think that who I was talking about, let's see. First of all, I had to listen to the team. The team is the group that that makes the institution. The institution is not just like this monolithical thing, but it's made of people. So it was about asking questions to them. It was about listening to their own experience at the institution, not only through the debates, but through the work that they had been doing recently and throughout the several years. Yeah, at that time, I would say in 2017, when the decision was made to change the name, it was made by the institution, but that didn't mean that everyone within the institution agreed. And I think that at my arrival, I had to understand what were the reasons for why people made the motion of making a name change, and what were the reasons for why others were uncomfortable or in disagreement with that motion. And there is a lot to learn from that, because as I said, institutions are made by people. It's not that I say it, it's just generally how it is.
It's just a fact.
It's just a fact. And I think that those, ultimately the team tends to be the most important stakeholder or the most immediate stakeholder of any organization. So I think that that's really where I began. And on the one hand, from my arrival up until now, the team has actually changed a lot. There are people that are no longer there, and there are people that are new at the institution. The same goes when I speak of the team. I also want to speak about the board, because it's part of that same community that makes the institution. you know, the conversation also led me to listen to and understand better some of the authors and signers or co-signers of the open letter, of who I met several. And I also met a number of the people that participated in the Cinema Holanda project. That is a project titled Platform, Cinema Holanda Platform, at its iteration at our institution. It's a project by Wendelin van Oldenburg that was being presented concurrently with us in 2017 and as an exhibition installation at the Venice Biennale. And that is really the project that stirred a lot of these conversations. So Wendelin van Oldenburg was someone that I wanted to listen to. Of course, Lucy Cotter was a curator of the Venice Pavilion, and Daphne Ayas, who is a former director of our institution, together with a former curator, Natasha Hoare, were the organizers of the Cinema Holanda platform at our institution. So it was really just a getting a sense of what were the positions, the different positions that people had, whether as an organizer or maker of the institution's program, or as a person that had signed or authored the letter. And of course, also what were the perspectives from people that had been very much part of the institution's history, because they were artists that had exhibited there, because they were curators that had worked there, because they were audience members that had had a long-standing relationship to the institution. So the first, the first couple of years, it was really listening and meeting up and understanding what were the positions of what had been our stakeholders, many of which decided not to accompany the institution, but many of who did, and also how those conversations were shaping the identification of new stakeholders and how to form new stakeholders for an institution that was for sure going through a significant transformation that was necessary. So that's really what happened at my arrival and what happened for the first couple of years, in which you mentioned at the introduction, and in which many people have also noted that nothing was seemed to be happening. But the truth is that a lot of groundwork was being developed in order to form stakeholders that would support an institutional transformation, because without that support, institutions really cannot survive.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that sounds like an immense amount of very intense work.
Yeah.
So we're curious about how all this research kind of shapes your decisions in, what actions to take. And so one of the first things that you did when you entered MELI was to create the position for the curator of collective learning.
Yeah.
We want to know, why did you find this role to be important, and how has it shaped or contributed to the process of transforming the institution?
That's a great question. And it goes back to the fact that it's people who make institutions, who transform institutions, who contribute to them. And in the case of the curator for collective learning, who is Jesse Koyman since 2018, the idea was to create a position that really bridged the exhibition makers, meaning the curatorial team, with the educators and mediators, meaning with those that were engaged to interpret not only the content of exhibitions, but also to engage the public more meaningfully in understanding what tends to be challenging work, difficult work, or that is how it's generally perceived as it pertains contemporary art and, I would even say, research-based practices. And, when people go to museums, they are looking at a work, whether it's the Rijksmuseum or the Maritime Museum, they're looking at objects or artifacts or artworks that have been there for a long time. And they were made centuries ago, and there is a whole history that presents the utility or the values as it pertains heritage or legacies that the works are there, you know, that they have. And one can contest that, but at least one knows that there is centuries of interpretation that have been made. In the case of art that is being made today, sometimes it's even difficult for the so-called experts to even make sense of it, just because it's really experimental and it's barely happening. So our institution has been broadening its audience for already a decade. And that has involved bringing younger people and people whose first contact with art of the present is happening at our galleries. So what meant then a position of the curator of collective learning for our institution was that it was very clear that we needed to bridge better the research and the mediation that was being done in between the teams that were making the exhibitions and the teams that were making the mediation. So that's number one. And the second one was that it was very clear that the institution had primarily developed these two poles, new audiences with first contact to art of the present, and on the other hand, existing audiences and recurring audiences that were experts in contemporary art, meaning they were part of the so-called culture industry that focuses on contemporary art and that is very much, I would say, challenged as part of the decolonizing efforts that happen within both academia and outside of it, right? And certainly in relationship to the marketplace. What we didn't have was a bridge that could also engage the public that was concerned in more general and pressing cultural issues of the times that may or may not be addressed through art or arts mediation, but that certainly has to do with the way in which our transformation had been triggered. Cultural issues that relate to representation in the sense of, yes, as you said it, the authors and most of the signers of the letter, open letter that triggered the name change were Black people and people of color. And they were demanding a kind of accountability as it pertained whose discourse was being given visibility there and whose decision-making process involved, you know, showcasing or representing certain ideas with so much strength. So for me, the curator of collective learning, Jesse Koyman, who was elected, was one that would help us in a transformation that engaged not only with the public, general public more meaningfully, but that would help us create new stakeholders and together with us pose the questions that would be necessary to address as part of our transformation. And that has certainly happened. It's taken time because it's not easy to just create new forms of engagement with the existing audience or to create new audiences that are meaningfully engaged and that would feel excited, committed, and yeah, safe to pose the questions that would allow us to take on a new institutional path so that we could remain being relevant and timely to the local public and at the same time meaningful to the international audiences that have always been following us.
Right. That's also quite a task. Yeah. I mean, appealing to all these different audiences and engaging them on different levels.
Yeah, let's just say that they're different audiences, but I also have to be, I mean, this sounds like, oh, you know, we're an institution that, you know, we're small, we're not having thousands of people a day and such, you know, this is not exactly a mainstream institution. So we are able to work, the audiences are very connected and they are broad, but that doesn't mean that there's thousands of people. So we're able to work closely and have intimate conversations that are meaningful precisely because of the sheer size that our institution is. The institution, even if it's smallish, it does, however, have a significant impact. And I think that that's also why the name change at our institution has been much more heavy-weighted than anyone would have thought. Yeah.
In our introduction, we were talking about this one particularly dramatic moment which kind of triggered a series of events which actually led to the name change. We're going to get to that. it wasn't until the summer of 2020 that this happened. And for our audience outside of the art scene, we want to explain what a big deal this was within the Dutch art scene. So in the heat of the summer of Black Lives Matter protests, an image from the Witte de Wit Instagram account popped up on our feeds showing these multiple bloody handprints on the side of the gallery walls. And when you tapped on the post, you noticed that all the other posts on the account were deleted. And the caption said something along the lines of announcing that the name change was going to finally happen.
Yeah. So which posts were deleted? I didn't
manage the Instagram account.
Fair enough. Sounds like you have a lot on your plate. Yeah. Before, yeah.
No. Well, I just remember tapping on this photo myself, and I noticed there were no other posts anymore. And then at some point, the entire account had disappeared because, of course, it was no longer called Witte de Wit Contemporary Art Center. And watching from the outside...
You mean the post in our account?
Yes.
Nah, hombre, how is that possible?
Maybe it's not. I don't know.
Maybe it was an alternative account.
But yeah, actually, it could have been an alternative account.
It is possible. I mean, these things happen.
Yeah, no. We've never deleted. Are you kidding me? We can't delete our account. It's a precious communication channel.
Okay.
No.
So that's interesting, too, because...
Yeah, then maybe it was an alternative account, which... I mean, there's so many fakes.
It's true. It's true. Yeah. And it's social. This is also coming at a time where the cultural climate is very tense. It's very tense within the art scene, going from academies to galleries and broader. Yeah, it was a time of reckoning for all of us, really. So, yeah, you also saw a lot of accounts that popped up that were basically calling out institutions. And it is possible that there was a copycats account. So that may be. In any case, watching from the outside, it felt like things only started to come into motion after the incident with the paint on the walls. So we wanted to ask, what was the chain of events that led to finally deciding on a new name?
Yeah. So I think that you've raised something important, which is what is the mediatization of, you know, a sequence of events or of processes or of realities. And I think that it seemed, and that's the right word, seemed that we had just begun doing the work at that point, right after the building was painted red or with red hands as part of a demonstration of a group of artists and cultural makers here in Rotterdam. And that was done not only to call on the fact that we were still called at that time, Witte de Wit Center for Contemporary Art, but that it was a colonial, that the name was a colonial representation, as is the institution for them. And at the same time that we had been painted with red hands, many other statues within the Netherlands had also the same type of marking. Mm-hmm. So, and the statues were of colonial figures. Mm-hmm. Now, we didn't respond to that like, oh, yes, now we're going to change the name. That is not the case. We had been working on a number of initiatives that would have been announced earlier in the spring. So we're talking about June 2020. And the fact of this is that we had 6 months before presented to our board the roadmap of the different public activities that would take place throughout the year, beginning that spring of 2020 and concluding in the fall, that would engage the public in different capacities and through different formats, forums and online activities, so that we could identify a new name for our institution. By June, none of that had actually taken place because of the pandemic of COVID. And one of the things that we were very aware throughout that spring was that we had to reformat things. And it was very, it was a very uncertain time. The times were basically, we thought that the lockdown was maybe only going to be 3 months or something, maybe only 2 months. We didn't know when we were replanning everything during the course of the spring. And one of the things that we were very clear is that we had begun already having all these meetings on Zoom, that at the time was like the program that everyone was learning about. And we had discussed that maybe we should begin throughout the summer doing the online forums. It was still at the end of May when we said, if we do it like that, then we're not going to really have the engagement that we want. Because in the summer, very few people really want to engage. Maybe we move them to the fall. So the whole point is that when the Black Lives Matter movement really arrived into this global stage, it was June, and we were very aware that we had to do something, knowing that there was going to be for us what we would call an anniversary of the open letter that had in 2017 really mobilized our institution to change. And so we said, let's prepare so that we make an announcement on that same day, on the weekend of June 13th, 14th, knowing that it's a moment that we can acknowledge the fact that we owe a response, that we are indebted, that our name basically calls on a debt, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, to that position paper that was really the source and inspiration for our institutional transformation. So when the building was marked as part of an activist call to our institution and to the Netherlands at large for not addressing meaningfully or urgently, I would say, the colonial histories that shed light on a lot of the, in their new investigation on, you know, the structural racism that exists here and elsewhere. Yeah, we were stunned, but it doesn't mean that we weren't ready. What we decided to do was that same weekend, we launched the invitation for the public forums, and we basically had planned already that seemed, again, as a response, but, you know, bad timing. It was a horrible. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, we decided that we would at least not announce a name, because we didn't want to announce a name that we came up with, but that we respected the process of the public forums that we really wanted to engage, people with, that there was a participation. So what we decided to do was not announce the name at that time, which we didn't have, and we could have just invented one, but the point was, no, all these years of building stakeholders and building a new rapport with the public, we're going to continue with our open forums. We'll announce them at that time. And what we will also announce is the day in which our new name will change, which was 27th of January of 2021. And basically, that's what we did. We put up a banner in our building that said, on this day, there's going to be a name change. There was a website published in that banner and through our social media and newsletters, inviting people to engage in the process that had been designed and redesigned and rescheduled to participate through public forums and through an online survey and through many different activities on the ways in which we would engage with the questions that had been posed throughout these years that we felt were important to consider for identifying a new name. And so that's what happened. Mm-hmm. It was really June 2020 was a moment that we were shaken. Everyone was shaken by, because really the urgency of the Black Lives Matter pressed on us. And, you know, the amount of critique that we received for, quote unquote, not having done anything, or for the protracted name change, or for, you know, it really, we felt terrible. I felt terrible. The entire team felt that we felt terrible. And that's how it goes. A mediatization of these accusations that you haven't done anything really has a toll. Mm-hmm. And, what we can say, is overshadowed by the amount of critique that social media can foster.
Absolutely.
Not to call it it's really social media has such a force, but and they called us out, and we cried. We had stomach aches and insomnia, and it was just very sad to be called out. And I mean, things really had been going well at the institution up until that point. And by that, I mean the institution had really been creating an effort to change and engage meaningfully, yeah, with the critiques that have been done. And we still do. It's just that at that time, holy shit, it really felt difficult.
Yeah, geez. Thank you so much for laying that out for us and for sharing that perspective. Of course, as community members and like people in the scene, you don't obviously do not see a lot of what's happening behind closed doors. But I was curious about how you use the word debt in relation to your relationship with the open letter. Can you talk a little bit about that? Is that something that's coming from you, or what do you mean?
Well, I'm very happy that you asked this question, actually. A name is a debt is a sentence that was very inspirational for me. It's a sentence that I drew out from an essay by the scholar and thinker and amazing person called Paul B. Preciado.
Okay.
And Paul B. Preciado used to be called Beatriz Preciado.
Yeah.
And is someone that I've been reading a lot for the past decade. I think that that he's one of the most exciting thinkers of our times. I'm not a fan of all the writing, but there's certainly a number of pieces that have been instrumental for me, for my thinking or rethinking of everything from architecture to gender. And Paul Preciado, as in the process of changing gender, and also went through the process of course, changing names. And in this essay that was published by Documenta 14, he speaks to the bureaucratic processes that are very lengthy and also very inspirational to think philosophically about the power structures that facilitate or that create the obstacles for change. So he speaks basically of what he had to undergo to change his name from Beatriz to Paul. And in that process, an interesting anecdote that he speaks of is of the fact that he had to publish the death, an official publication of the death of Beatriz as a kind of civil document that you need to do in the city council in Spain, and the birth of Paul Preciado's publication as well. So that those institutional documents, those government documents, could actually be used for attesting the gender and name change. And I have to say that we had to go through, at our institution, a number of paperwork, of course, as well to change the name, you know, and say our statuten had to change and et cetera. But ultimately, I drew the line and thought a lot about the ways in which a name is a debt. And for me, it's true. It's the same of if you think of your last name. Again, if you go through the normative traditions of bear a normative name that has been given to you at birth. And that means that you have a legacy to account for. Your parents, depending on the relationship that your family has, will demand that you use their name with a kind of pride or history that you've inherited. And that is why I said, do we owe anything to Vita de Vita Man?
Right.
And I don't know if that's something that you could respond. And the question for us is, who do we owe this name to, right? And our new name, Meli, is in a way accountable to an immediate community, right? And also to an artist and our institutional history. So that's where the idea of a debt comes from. In the case of another author that has been influential to not only the open letter authors and signatories, but also to Gwendolyn Van Oldenburg and Lucy Cotter, Natasha Hoare, Daphne Ayas, and to so many other people right now in the Netherlands, is, of course, the book of Gloria Wecker, White Innocence. And in her writing about, you know, a structural racism in the Netherlands, which is what the book is addressing, she also talks about disavowal and the process of acknowledging blind spots or acknowledging institutional structures that must change beyond just a name and the symbolics of a name, but policies that have to be considered or drafted focuses that have to be brought to the institution, disavowal and debt are central, right? It's like, who are we indebted and who have we disavowed that we now have to pay attention to? So I think that those are central operative. They're operative terms. They're terms that allow you to really open and speak to in different regards, right?
That's a really beautiful parallel that you've drawn. And talking about, yeah, a name as a debt.
Yeah.
And also, like, to approach this process from that perspective. Like, what do we owe this name to? And that's wonderfully put.
Yeah.
Yeah, and to who, right? And with who? It also speaks to a power relation that is important to, that is important to acknowledge. Who can change a name? Who can question a name? Who do we think it has the power, you know, to represent? What does a name represent in the end? So I think that all those things are, when I say again, it's an operative term, is that it raises again the focus on the power structures that are embedded and sometimes silenced or unspoken of, but that ultimately have to be addressed now and always, of course, when you speak of positions and representation and a visibility or lack of visibility.
Our entire podcast, I guess for this season at least, will be about apologies. And as we were doing research about Melly, we were wondering, like, did Melly give an apology? To me, it also sounds like your actions have been more of the atonement, perhaps. But we were wondering if there's been an apology from Melly.
Or even a request.
Yeah, or a request for an apology.
Apology to who?
Well, that is the question.
Right,
Because reading the open letter and also just knowing a little bit about the conversations that happened between some of the people who wrote this letter, one of the issues was how the institution reacted to begin with. Has there been some resolution between these relationships in this whole process?
Yes, that's a. I don't know what a resolution could look like. Mm-hmm. I think that, in the sense that I think that many people that have been part of the process were also part of both Cinema Holanda and the open letter, and for them, I mean, if I think that resolution is the fact that they've continued coming to the institution or that they've returned again to the institution once the name had changed, maybe that's a form of resolution.
Right.
That's one of the ways in which I would think what resolution could look like or feel like. But there's not exactly, I don't think that, first of all, I don't think that our transformation has ended with the name change. On the contrary, it's the name change is only one thing, I would even say, at the start of an institutional transformation. We're still really in the works, you know, and we're in the process of a change that must be continuous so that we are, you know, addressing many of the questions that were in that letter and that were posed also throughout the process. For example, one of them was, how do we, as an institution, how can we influence the way in which education is delivered or thought about in the Netherlands? So that's a question that has been posed, and we're very interested in advocating for, an institutional change, not only within us, but in the education sector at large, that could address better the historical past and the way in which it influences us in the value systems that we create nowadays. So I would say that resolution will take different shapes, and that I can identify one kind of resolution in the sense that certain members of the public that were critical to our institution and had distanced themselves from our institution have come back or have continued coming and learning with us. So I think that that's one. Now, as it pertains in terms of apology, and when I ask to who, I'm not sure. I think that on a personal level, I think that institutional apologies are something very different. But on a personal level, maybe I do have some apologies to make. Does that count?
I mean, yeah. Yes. I mean, like say, an institution is made up of individuals. I mean, but
Yes. But I don't want to speak right now for the entire institution because I think that
understandable
that it's very different right now. When I say, like, I personally feel that I would like to apologize, is we just did a conversation that was also a kind of, I asked a couple of questions to the team, for example, so that there was not a lot of peer pressure. I asked them digitally, right, through writing rather than in-person workshop. And one of them was, what do you think is clear? And, you know, what do you think about the process of the name change that we're in and when the name change took place and where we're in right now in the transformation? And I read from several of the team members that they felt that it had taken too long for us to give a new name, for us to find a new name. And so I think that I owe an apology to them and also to some of the critical members of the public that have also thought that the name change was protracted. And, you know, the truth is that, yeah, for me, it was just necessary to take this long to be able to listen to more people. And I am very aware that my proposed communication strategies were futile. They didn't work. And yeah, I should have been much more communicative, more transparent, more timely with even my responses to questions about when the name change would happen. So I think that personally, I apologize for not being quick enough. I'm a hurricane, like I really am very fast in certain things. And in this case, you know, I think that it's a combination of not knowing really how to go about it and not knowing the context well enough and feeling the burden of responsibility to learn more about possible consequences to make a change. So I think that the timeliness is something that I had just a different clock. And I asked for time. I said, just give me time, please, so that we could do these through meaningful engagements that take time to develop. So I am, and for sure, the way in which communication, in which my reporting, because I began reporting about structural changes happened, it was just not the right way to go. I published in a website a report in 2018 and in 2019, and we also published those reports in our annual year accounts or in annual reports, which are also online, but it's just not, they were not visible enough and there was no effort to make them even more visible. We thought that just by hanging them online in our website was enough, and that's just not the case. So I also apologize for not having been as strategic in the communication as it was in the planning of other aspects. I also, I think, I don't know, I want to apologize to so many other people. I think that the involvement perhaps of the former team members or of the exiting team members, their continued involvement in the name change process may have been also relevant for them in the last couple of years, for them to have even more proximity to it rather than have thought that their departure was a sense of closure. So, yeah. I mean, I can continue and continue, eh?
No. This is
you don't have to.
This is an ample amount of apologies.
I was I'm not religious, but I was formed Catholic, so believe me, the process of apology
confessional style.
And confession and all these things has been ingrained in my blood, you know? But yeah, but ultimately, I think that that's that. It's been quite a roller coaster of emotions, this entire process. And the truth is that no one even wants to interview me about the amazing programs we do.
That's true.
And the amazing and the amazing structural transformations that have happened, because that's actually quite amazing. I mean, just the structural transformations and the team that we have and the programs that they do and the audiences that they've engaged with, the artists and the subject matters that that they're dealing with. I mean, it's just quite amazing. And the exhibitions and the artists and the events that are happening. I mean, it's just really, you know, something worth really an interview. And you can interview me about that. But there's also a lot of very vocal, very articulate, very fun, very interesting people that are part of our team that you could engage with. Because, yeah, you'll get a side of the institution that's just really much more fun and equally interesting than the name change. I think that the name change is such a heavy subject that it's like, you get bogged down, I think, by even listening. I mean, I can't even listen to myself speak anymore about it, but that's how it goes.
Yeah. We can imagine. So, anyone out there who wants to do an interview on the other sides of Melly, feel free.
Yeah, I think that it's really, the program is really interesting. And the process of the name change, as I said, of the stakeholders has involved really creating, you know, a working group of emerging professionals, of young people from Rotterdam that are really taking the institution to a different place. So the name change really involved a number of the people that remain working now at our institution or involved in programming or involved in one capacity or the other. So I think that that's the fun part of it. And you could see that really happening right now with the COVID and the pandemic and the lockdowns. Yeah. It's really difficult to get a sense of the institutional positive vibration and good energy flow. But believe me, it's there and it's very captivating, I would say.
Well, I think that's really exciting to hear, honestly, to have gone through such a difficult process for so many years, and then to come out of it on the other side, really seeing the transformation that you invested in as a team, as a community. So, million-dollar question. What do you think other institutions can learn from this experience?
Well, I think that, one, institutions really have to think the ways in which not only through their program, but through their policies and through their team can make a change in society. I think there's a lot of expectation, a lot of demand from the public to be institutions that are locally connected. And you can be internationally connected as well, but that doesn't exclude you from really making a local contribution. I think that's one thing that we've learned, and that many other institutions like ours, which have focused on contemporary art, which is a quote unquote very global. Yeah, we just have to really remind ourselves that we can continue being globally connected and be presenting international content and artists, but we have to engage our local communities by reminding them how we are also connected globally, because we have shared concerns with people outside of our immediate context. I think that a second thing that we really learned, and it was very hard, a hard lesson, is that we have to communicate better. And as institutions, and that means how do we, you know, bring academic language, if at all, into a more familiar terms? And how do we also, you know, poetically address what's familiar and common so that it is, you know, understood in terms of their poetics. I feel that another thing to possibly learn from our process is that you don't have to, you know, there was a lot of concern that I had. I know it may sound dumb, but I think that we're a very serious institution. Like, we're very committed to scholarship, and scholarship is not just the academics. It's also understanding that there's other forms of knowledge and other languages that the visual arts produces here and elsewhere. And I take it very seriously, but things don't have to sound very serious. And so I was very nervous at times that people would think that because Melly, which is a very soft name, it didn't sound serious enough, and that perhaps people wouldn't take us serious enough. But at this point, I don't care. Yeah, and I think that one of the things that we have to learn from that we learned from this, and that I suggest other institutions to learn, is that, you know, that we are just so used to the conventions of the corporate world of acronyms, right? With all these contemporary arts, OCA, I was really a champion, like, well, we can name ourselves CAT, the Contemporary Art Center, or Kunst. And in the end, I'm like, you know, it's if you let go of these conventions and just have a little bit more fun, you can become more accepting of things that are softer without the fear that they will be, that they won't be taken seriously. And I think that that was a lesson that was learned and that maybe others, other institutions can also learn from that, is that it's about how, it's about your terms of engagement and not just about the terms that you wish to engage with, right?
That is so beautiful.
I love that so much.
I thought that it sounded dumb.
But that's also,
this is what we're about.
Yeah,
honestly.
And this is also, I think, what you're touching upon, right? And what can be so difficult in the cultural sector is like sometimes just doing things that are more playful and fun and sometimes more from the heart. And then always having this, okay, is it taken seriously, you know?
Yeah.
So thank you.
I think we're both really happy to hear this.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So great. And I think I'm more of a person, but there's a team that's not only that they also have a great sense of humor. And I also think that we should all learn to have a better sense of humor. For me, it's really been a challenge, I have to say. But that's another lesson learned. I think that we really have to have a sense of humor because these processes are just very challenging to many of us. And if you don't have a sense of humor, you get bogged down and turn into like this conservative person that is fearful and such. So I think that I do think that social changes that we're going through right now have to be taken with a sense of humor so that change could actually be possible. Otherwise, we'll be just stuck in our own conventions and, become conservatives. And in the arts, again, a sense of humor and a lightness of being is essential for institutions, and that's what we've learned.
Now we have some audience questions to wrap up with.
Yes.
Oh, there's more. Okay. Okay.
Those are just our questions.
Okay.
We just have a few, but we'll just do them like quickly. And I think you've maybe touched upon some of them.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So our first is from Laura, and it is a two-parter. So did you experience a lot of resistance within the institution regarding the name change? That's the first part of the question. Mm-hmm. And the second part is, what needs to happen with cultural heritage that is offensive or harmful to other people?
Yeah. So the first question is easy. I would say that the staff is very collaborative. I would say that I did feel resistance a bit at my arrival in 2018. I'm not sure if it was because of the name change itself. I think that it was because of, I don't know, because of the many changes that had to happen at the institution. So there was some kind of resistance in terms of the structural transformations that were taking place. And, you know, that comes in waves. I felt that there was a lot of, it was a fact. There was a lot of contention, a lot of discontent, a lot of discussion, but in the end, a negotiated peace, I would say, back in June 2020, when we really felt the pressures of, as I said, the Black Lives Matter movement pressuring us to already change the name by that point. So there was division amongst the team of whether we should actually make a name change at that time or respect the process that we had designed together. And in the end, that was discussed in a very intensified way. And I took up the responsibility to say, we're going to wait. We're going to announce the date of the name change, but we're not going to give a new name, even though we had three options that we were discussing at that time. And we said, no, the whole point is not for us to come up with the names, but for us to come up with a process by which public participation can happen and from which a name can come about. So that was another moment of resistance, I would say. But again, it was negotiated with the team, and it's a great team. So everyone worked around their differences, and we continued. Now, as it pertains, and in terms of the supervisory board, they've been very supportive, and even through very tough times and through a lot of people also calling them and pressuring them at one point or other for making name change. So it's quite a great community that has endured a lot of challenges. In terms of the second question, it's a question that I can give some thoughts, share some thoughts, but I'm not sure if there's a clear answer. I think that it's really a question that can only be asked in a positioned way, right? Meaning in my position, so I could speak to in my position in Rotterdam, that I work at an institution that changed its name, but it's an institution that's located in a street that has the name that was critiqued, but that has not changed its name. Mm-hmm. What can I say? I feel that the city, for example, and by that I mean not only the governors, but also the citizens of Rotterdam, can reflect on the ways and on the reasons for why we changed our name as an institution. And it's up to the city to also, meaning to the citizens and to its governors, to really take on the discussion of whether the street name should change, for example. See? So I do not feel that I am the person to raise that question for a very basic reason. I'm not a Dutch person, see? And I'm not Dutch. I'm living here. I love it here. I'm very committed to advancing the cultural scene in Rotterdam and in the Netherlands. But at the same time, I feel that I have other priorities and responsibilities. And I have I also know what my limits are in terms of, like, I know what I can change, see? And I'm very strategic in that, because I think that I'm aware that the influence that our institution can have in other cultural institutions is significant. I'm not sure if we've been able to influence so much, for example, the city or its politicians and citizens to make changes like the one that we've made that pertain to heritage that is dissonant. And I think that it is the role of also educators and not just cultural workers within the art scene to be able to pose these questions of heritage. And there's a lot of work, academically speaking, and also in terms of groups that are self-organized, that want changes to be made, and that means that you have to begin having public discussions and debates. And there are, of course, public discussion and debates, but whether they have enough visibility or strength to impact the decision makers, that's something to consider, right? In what way can some of the decision makers of, you know, public commissioners of new statues, for example, and also the ways in which there are people responsible for the existing statues that are part of the city's heritage and the names of streets or plazas that are part of the city's heritage, but that are also perhaps painful, or perhaps clearly painful to many communities. What are we going to do with that? That's a conversation that has to happen with the larger groups and stakeholders. And we're happy to be part of them. And we have had a number of these conversations already, as many institutions and groups have also had. It's just that why they have no larger impact is a question. So what do we do? We have to begin by addressing the ways in which they're hurtful. And as I said, that's already been underway. How can we create a more sensitivity towards that, so that pain is understood, that there's a kind of empathetic relationship to that? And it's pain that not only comes, you know, it's pain from many groups, not just from people that are of color, people that have slavery as part of their historical and personal background. It's also painful for the people that have always seen this heritage as their own, and that it's normative to have it. So how can we understand, you know, the ways in which we can be empathetic to them, but at the same time be able to change people's heart, change people's mind, so that there's resolution, no?
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for laying out all the factors that need to be considered in such a question. So we've taken up quite a bit of your time, and you've actually covered a lot of the questions that were asked by listeners such as Carlota, Lara, and Henrietta. So we're going to leave you with one more question, and this is from our listener E, which is, an institution exists through and is upheld by people. So how did the personal intertwine with the institutional in Melly's transformation?
I mean, I think that we're all, as part of a team, we embodied the process full on, meaning everyone was really invested emotionally, intellectually, physically in the name change process. So I think that the personal is in this way. I mean, I think that one of the things that coming back to mediatization that we were very aware that we didn't know how to address was the fact that every time our institution was criticized, we took it very personally. Because in fact, a lot of the critiques were personal, that I or so-and-so wasn't doing the work or wasn't doing the work right. You know, I think that everyone was very disappointed. Mm-hmm. Many of the critiques also were done publicly in social media. And I think that for us, it was very difficult to be reading that. We were very affected by it, but we also knew that, yeah, maintaining rapport so that we weren't affected by it and can continue doing the very demanding work, it was necessary. Yeah, I think that the personal is in that sense. And of course, in terms of the personal, you know, many people in the team and outside of the team voiced opinions as part of the name change process itself. And that meant that, you know, everyone was listening to each other very deeply. And sometimes, again, the difference of opinion can be, you know, intense, but that's how it goes. So I don't know how else to say. I mean, we take very seriously embodied knowledge. And by that, I mean speaking of and listening to experiences. So I think that really is something that is just very demanding on a personal level.
Yeah, that's
clear.
But
I'm not sure if I'm responding to the
question
correctly.
Yeah, you absolutely are.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
So thank you so much, Sophia. I think you've been really open and honest and incredibly articulate about, a very difficult subject.
And also very vulnerable. Yeah. So we really, really appreciate that.
Okay. I have to say that the team... always one board member, Yolanda van der Heide, she gave us feedback and she said, this is a very vulnerable process and you have to embrace it, like don't shy away from it. And I think that for me and for the entire team, that was actually quite an important suggestion because it was good. And again, it's not about suffering. We've had a very good time, even though sometimes we felt that the entire world hated us, and that was probably the case. But I think that the team is very lovable, and, you know, we kept together, and that was what's very important, and we are very committed to serving the public. So I think that, please come and join us when we have programs.
Yeah, for sure. So, yes, for our listeners, if you would like to visit Melly and see the excitement yourself, they are in Rotterdam, and you can find them online as well. Thanks once again, Sophia, for joining us.
No, thank you both for inviting me to Bard Talk. I'm very happy that we had this conversation.
That was Sophia Hernandez-Chonkui on this episode of Bard Talk. I'm Yoon Lee.
And I'm James Parnell. If you like what you heard, you can follow us on Instagram or Facebook. And be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast. We also made a transcript of this episode, which you can find on our website. You can find links to related resources in the show notes of this episode.
We want to thank Hans Poole for recording and editing these podcasts, Nia Konstantinova for doing our PR, Denise Lee for designing the banner, and Serafina Van Os for transcribing our podcasts.
Thank you so much for listening to this season of Bard Talk. We have learned so much in making the season and are really thankful for all of the wisdom and experience that our guests have shared. We hope that this series inspires you to repair some relationships, maybe make some amends, and build a better apology-friendly future.